One of the first actions I remember doing in that role was inviting nurses that were part of our email list to write their own letter to the editor of their local newspaper. And we got dozens of newspapers to print these letters to the editor.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Jess Kutch is the founder of Coworker.org, which provides tools for workers to start, run, and win campaigns to change their workplaces. It is through their platform that baristas have won the right to have visible tattoos and scheduling reform at Starbucks and paid parental leave at Netflix, among other things. Jess has 15 years' experience working at the intersection of technology and social change. Prior to launching Coworker.org, Jess led a team at Change.org. She also spent 5 years at the Service Employees International Union, where she pioneered digital strategies for the labor movement. Jess has won a variety of major prizes and fellowships for her work. So Jess and I discussed her path to starting Coworker, as well as her challenges and successes building that organization. So after our sponsor, my interview with Jess Kutch at Coworker.org.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Jess. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. So I'm Jess Kutch. I'm the co-founder and co-executive director of Coworker.org. I have worked, about 15 years in the labor movement and economic justice space. And I currently live with my family in Western North Carolina.
Jess, would you mind telling me how you first got involved in the political space?
Sure. So I grew up in Central Connecticut, single parent, only child household. And I would say there were three major forces in my life that really shaped my professional ambitions and just kind of perception of the world in general. The first was the arrival of the internet. For me, I sort of logged onto what was the proto-internet of AOL. Back then, it was called America Online in about 1993. And it was there that I began to build community. It was there that I came out as gay when I was 15 for the first time to anybody. And it was there that I, you know, got interested in punk music and found rides to shows. And so the internet played a pretty big role in my life early on, and it really convinced me of the potential of technology to find and form community. The other major forces in my life would be just having grown up with a single parent who was trying to be a freelancer in the late 80s, early 90s, when it wasn't pretty common, and just living with the financial precarity of that occupation and only having one earning parent. You know, I just saw the differences between what was going on in our household and what was maybe going on in you know, my friends' families. My mom moved us to a wealthier suburb. At one point, I was in fifth grade at that time. And having moved from a blue-collar city to a wealthier suburb, I really began to see inequity and difference. And I even became a little angry about it, not having the nicer clothes and just the pressures that kids put on themselves and feel to fit in with their peers. And so I think, you know, even though I wasn't taken to protests, I know a lot of the folks in our field, you know, grew up going to rallies and had parents who were maybe politically involved. That was not my experience. I sort of found it on my own.
Talk a little about like how you went from that background to college, which was in Vermont, I think. How did that come together?
Well, it was one of the places that accepted me. I wasn't the greatest student. I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I left high school. I applied, you know, to colleges that were for graphic design, which is what my mother is. She's a graphic designer. I was interested in politics and communication type stuff. You know, Bennington appealed to me because it was a completely unstructured environment. No grades, no tests, really, no requirements. And, you know, I had my own kind of side hustles. I had a zine that I was making in high school. I had a garage band. I didn't really want to be told that I had to take certain classes. So it ended up working out really well. I mean, I found that the Bennington experience incredibly rewarding and a good fit for me academically. I was able to like pursue what I was deeply interested in and didn't have to spend time, you know, although I do regret not taking like a statistics course at least once.
What was the main thing that you took away from there in terms of learning? Like, was there a key course or a teacher or anything?
Interesting question. I mean, I think for me, the experience of, you know, studying political philosophy and cultural anthropology, Chinese history, in a place that's mostly focused on the arts, really helped me see the benefits of being in an environment where people maybe think differently than you. And, you know, I've tried to bring that into my own work of, you know, how can we think outside the box, be more creative, collaborate with folks that maybe people in our space, activists, nonprofit organizations, don't necessarily think to seek out.
Talk about how you moved into the work world after college.
Leaving college, it was like there was a very small recession. I mean, compared to the most recent one, I think it was like the post 9/11 recession. And so it was a tough job market to dive into. I ended up applying for a job as a political organizer at Acorn. And they called me up and they were like, well, we don't think you're a good fit for that, but you know, you can come out and go to this training and see if you want to be a community organizer. So there was a like 2-day training in Providence, Rhode Island, where they just like threw us in headfirst. You know, we were door knocking and flyering, and it was unlike anything I'd ever done before, and it was terrifying. But I also, I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the conversations I was having with people. So I was offered a job on the bus ride home from Providence, and I accepted. And so I lasted 6 months as a community organizer at Acorn. But I learned a ton.
What was the key thing you learned?
So, I mean, Acorn's model, as I understand it, and I'm sure other folks with more experience in the organization would maybe describe it differently, but the method of meeting someone, usually at their doorstep, and finding a connection with them and sort of figuring out what they care about, and having a conversation about how to address that, how to solve that problem that they care about in their community, in their neighborhood. And, you know, we can get to this later, but in many ways, that's the model of coworker.
I remember a summer I spent canvassing, and I learned a lot about people just by meeting them on the doorstep, meeting people I didn't know and trying to engage them as a pretty young man in conversation. It's quite an experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one I wish everyone could have, especially that works in this space.
So then you made it to Public Citizen. Is that right?
So not long after leaving Acorn, I actually left Connecticut I was working in Hartford, Connecticut at Acorn, and I like packed up all my stuff and just drove down to DC without a job. Found a room to rent in a house for like $425 a month. And, and had about enough savings to last about a month before I was gonna, you know, I had a plan of, I'd worked for 7 years in pizza delivery in high school and college. So I had a plan to go back to that if I needed to. But I ended up getting a job at Public Citizen as a legislative assistant in their Congress Watch division, which was a great experience. I had the opportunity to go to congressional offices every day and participate in lobbying visits, just see how the Hill worked. At the time, I really had these like dreams of one day working on the Hill, and I quickly realized that that was not that would not be a good fit for me. That I was much more content to be outside pushing rather than inside, seeing how all the sausage gets made.
Yeah. Did you start doing online organizing at Public Citizen?
Yeah. So at the time that I started working at Public Citizen, there were very few roles and organizations for online organizing, which is typically what we called it at the time. You know, that's when the blogs were, it was like 2004, 2005, the political blogs were blowing up. There seemed to be just a lot of energy and opportunity in that space, but most of the nonprofits hadn't caught up to that opportunity and didn't have roles in their organizations. So about, halfway through my stint at Public Citizen, I made the case to my director that this job was needed, that this was a huge opportunity for the organization. And he agreed and he let me write my own job description, which is how I became an online organizer. I just created the job and I guess I created, my career path from there. But
what was in that job description?
That's a good question. I really don't remember. I'm sure it was not too unlike what the job description might be today. I mean, the tool sets, unfortunately, aren't that different. A lot of, building an email list, having folks call Congress, sign petitions. I know there was a lot of like outreach and engagement with political bloggers that we wanted, having stories placed on Daily Kos, for example. And then also I was just managing the websites. And at that time, I probably shouldn't have been doing it, but I was doing a lot of the graphic design work for the website. And Public Citizen had several microsites dedicated to specific issues.
So you were there for 3 years. What came next?
Well, this is like a fun walkthrough of my CV.
I'm interested in the way people's paths kind of come together toward where they end up, now, like you, a political entrepreneur.
The next step was when I landed in the labor movement. The labor unions at the time were one of the few organizations that did have like digital staff, digital departments. And SEIU at the time had a department that was called the Web Services Department. And they were hiring, I don't even remember the original title, but it was essentially, a digital organizing role for their healthcare division. So it ended up being a great role. It was the first position at the International Union and probably across the entire union where a digital staffer actually embedded with like the field team and was like at the table when decisions were made and was playing a role and having some influence on how the campaign unfolded. So rather than the digital person being kind of an afterthought, and kind of an extension of maybe the comms team, I was really allowed to sit with the decision makers and really talk through, all the inflection points of a campaign and see how we could use digital, our email list, and the tools available to us to help meet the campaign's goals. We had a list of more than 300,000 registered nurses around the country at the time. So it probably was one of the bigger email lists that was strictly like focused on an occupation in the United States at the time. And we had a lot of fun, and I learned a ton.
Like what?
There's this thing that happens when you're behind a computer, as you probably know, that like it doesn't feel like the real world is on the other side of it. And so the things you're doing like maybe don't have real world consequences. But one of the first actions I remember doing in that role was inviting nurses that were part of our email list to write their own letter to the editor of their local newspaper. And we had, you know, a tool on our CRM, I think it was Get Active that we were using at the time, that could generate a letter and have it go to their local newspapers. And we got dozens of newspapers to print these letters to the editor. They were about, by the way, I should say the issue. It was about wage collusion. SEIU was suing one of the hospital chains around colluding to suppress nurse wages around the country. And so nurses were writing in about their legitimate concerns and experiences with low wages. And what came after that is one of the nurses actually was retaliated against and lost her job. Now, the union was able to, you know, having that infrastructure, the union kicked into high gear. And I believe that, you know, it was remedied in some way that she got her job back. But it was a wake up call for me. I was like 24 at the time, maybe 25, I don't know. But, you know, having an action that I thought, oh, this will be fun. And then there being this real world consequence was definitely eye opening.
Yeah, a lot at stake for both the nurses and I guess for the corporation in certain ways.
Right. Yeah.
So you I guess got a promotion to campaigns, digital campaigns manager along the way there.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I was there about 5 years. So and the digital team went through a lot of change during that time. It was during the 2008 presidential campaign that I was selected to run the union's digital operation around healthcare reform. And that was like a very big effort for the union and for a bunch of other organizations and unions around the country. A lot was invested in that. And so I had a team of people. They were in different parts of the country. And, you know, we were holding like teletown halls with pharmacists and nurses to sort of like elevate this call to action that we need healthcare reform. And then when Obama won, we kind of pivoted to, you know, the legislative process and just advocacy around moving certain members of Congress and leveraging a massive email list. And it was the first time I had really had resources as a digital organizer to take risks and do like creative, interesting things. One of my favorite things that we did at that time was we produced a series of videos. It was a spoof videos around the opposition's tactics to healthcare reform, and it was supposed to be about like the PR firm for the opposition, and the front group was called Harm Healthy Americans Against Reforming Medicine, and we worked with like comedians and talented writers to produce these videos. Laughing Liberally was involved, and you know, it was one of the most viewed videos. I think they still are in like the top 10 most viewed videos that SEIU has ever produced on YouTube. But we just had that freedom to do more interesting work. We also did some great work around, I mean, it's strange to say it that way, but around domestic violence being considered a pre-existing condition, as well as like C-sections. And so we elevated that issue and ended up having, because of my team's work on that issue, as well as folks in the policy and comms department at SEIU, that ended up becoming part of the bill that was passed in the House. So, yeah, it was a wild ride. And then after it was over, I was like, I don't want to do that again. I don't want to be involved in passing legislation. It was a great learning experience, but it wasn't, I think what I learned in that was that what I most enjoyed was the human connection and, you know, developing people's leadership skills and getting to know people, which is not something you get to do, when you're kind of tucked away in an 8-story building in DC, sending out emails every day.
So it was kind of frustrating, but you also were, as a fairly young person, mid-20s, kind of right in the middle of a national fight or a number of them.
Yes. Yes. I mean, of all of my memories of my professional life, like that year, it's just burned in my brain. it was a great opportunity, and I'm very lucky that I got to have it. And I got to work with some incredible people, just really talented people who've gone off and done great things. So I'm grateful for the experience for sure.
What'd you do next?
All right. So this is when the idea of coworker began to like creep into my mind. The Wisconsin Uprising, do you know that reference? Folks in the labor world call it the Wisconsin Uprising, but I'm not sure if others understand what that is. So
is that like reaction to Scott Walker's moves when he came in as governor?
Yes, exactly. And when the Capitol was occupied by students and educators and firefighters for days on end, I was in my apartment at night sending pizzas to the protesters. And at the time, I had spent, I guess at that point, maybe 4 years working at a labor institution and had been taught. And I think in some, many ways this was correct, but I was working under the assumption that people didn't care about collective bargaining, that those words were not used in our popular comms, like in our external facing communications. And here I saw 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds fired up about this idea that you should have the right to bargain, negotiate with your boss and join with your coworkers. And, those students were going to graduate into non-union workplaces. So my good friend who also worked at SEIU at the time, Michelle Miller, who was also coworkers co-founder, she and I just began to meet after work and, talk about what would we do for those folks? What would the solution look like? And being that my background is in digital organizing, I went to those ideas of like, what kinds of digital tools could these workers use to begin to experience collective power and to build that organizing muscle? From there, change.org came calling. At the time, Ben Rattray was going on a hiring spree around DC and around the country, scooping up a lot of folks that I knew and folks in the digital organizing space. And he offered me the opportunity to come to change.org and run the economic justice vertical on the platform. And he kind of said I would have the freedom to work on what I wanted and the issues that I cared about. And I saw that as a great opportunity to test this theory that we had been talking about, Michelle and I, over drinks a couple nights a week. And so so I arrived at change.org when I think it was still a staff of like 12 people. By the time I left, it was more than 50 or 60. And that was a wild ride. I mean, it was, change.org was very different from working in an old labor institution. It was a bit of an adjustment for me to get used to working in a startup environment. I also had the opportunity to just try a bunch of things. Like one of the things we worked on was preventing foreclosure on people's homes. And we just did a lot of foreclosure fight back campaigns. The cool thing about working at Change was I was the person talking to these petition creators every week. And so that human connection I wanted, I definitely had again. It was also it was a stressful job because, your campaigns don't always win, and there's always a fire somewhere. There's always something that's urgently needed. But I also had the opportunity to support workers running workplace campaigns at change.org, and began to see the possibilities there, but also the gaps. There was one campaign in November of, I think, 2011. By a Target employee named Anthony Hardwick, who was petitioning Target to be closed on Thanksgiving Day. And he was, you know, he was, I think, an employee now that I recognize quite well, which is somebody who can afford to speak out because they don't want to, they don't care that much about sticking around at their job, but they do care deeply about their coworkers. And they have like a sense of injustice about what's happening to them. And that kind of gives them the strength and courage to step out on that limb and to be the face of a campaign. And that campaign, you know, I saw thousands of Target employees around the country signing it. We actually had a Target warehouse worker named Seth Coleman, who signed Anthony's petition, agree to hand deliver it to Target headquarters because he lived about 40 minutes outside of Minneapolis, and actually flew there and drove Seth to the petition event. There was like national media there. Seth was shaking as he delivered his speech, which, you know, he alone had worked on. And it was, I think, like the authenticity of this, like truly grassroots, like these are just workers with strong opinions and demands, made it like it was media gold. And it was a very easy story to tell in the media because there were really no third parties involved, right? And I learned a lot about how to tell a good story in the media through those campaigns.
Did they get Thanksgiving off?
No, they did not win that campaign. Yeah. I mean, I think that campaign, though, I mean, this is where it comes down to, like, okay, there's one way to define success, which is the petition demand. And I agree that that's important. But there's also sort of like Anthony's campaign inspired a whole movement of workers that have taken action since on this issue and has created a dialogue around this that wasn't there. There was no worker angle to the Thanksgiving Black Friday stories until Anthony's campaign. And some retailers have, I don't know if Target has, but many retailers have like decided to walk away from that. Now, I don't know how much of that is because it wasn't a successful business strategy or, you know, because of their workers, but regardless, that campaign taught us or taught me that a general use platform like change.org could never provide the kind of specialized support that was needed to make sure that Anthony's campaign wasn't just this moment, but was actually a building block that was helping workers kind of create digital infrastructure for the next campaign or the next fight. Because, you know, those thousands of Target workers that joined that campaign were never again spoken to, you know, at change.org as Target workers. And that to me was like a huge loss, huge missed opportunity. So after that campaign happened, like Michelle and I had a conversation of just kind of like, we have to do this. There's no one else in the space that's set up to be able to try to do this right now. So if not us, who? And we
was Michelle also at Change?
No, Michelle had stayed at SEIU and then was doing some filmmaking freelance work. She's not a digital organizer. She had been a cultural organizer at the union and had run the union's like convention. She might have been just coming off of that convention when we spoke about needing to create Coworker. And so we started to have conversations and was just like people that we knew in the space that would have feedback for us about this idea. And we were both, through those conversations, we were both offered fellowships that kind of gave both of us the courage to quit our jobs and take the leap. Hers was a 4-month fellowship at the Georgetown Kalmanovitz Initiative. And mine was a 3-month fellowship at the New Organizing Institute. And so, Yeah, and they like those two organizations like collaborated with each other to like offer that to us at the same time.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah, stars aligned.
I'm definitely familiar with NOI and kind of lament that it's gone.
Same. Yeah, me too. That was my professional home for a long time.
So, during that time when you had that fellowship, what did you use it to do?
Well, we used it to, I think we had 100 conversations during that 3 month time frame. We kept a spreadsheet. So we just tried to talk to everyone we could think of. And we started to attract the resources that we needed to launch the site. I remember we spent a big portion of money on just buying the domain. And that was one of those moments where you're like, oh my God, are we gonna do this? Okay, this is real now.
Well, how
but
much
you
did it
know,
cost to buy that domain?
I think it was around $7,000, which is not,
So you
you
were
know.
serious about it. That's not petty cash.
Exactly. Yeah.
You think that was a good call?
Yeah, I think once we figured out what the name would be, and that was just a long process, all that whole summer of just talking it through and coming up with a million ideas. Once we figured out the name, we loved the name and we knew.
I mean, what was the reasoning behind the name?
Well, I think when you go through a creative process like that, you're not necessarily like you're thinking about what the work will involve. What's it going to look like? What's the user experience going to be? And then you're thinking of like words, images that come to mind with that. We definitely batted around like worker bee, like beehives, that kind of imagery, but nothing felt quite right. And then one day it's just the idea came to one of us. I think it was me, but that this is about coworkers coming together, and we liked that it was open to interpretation. The only thing that has been a little annoying is the hyphen and not having the hyphen and having it spelled differently in 100 different publications for that reason. But no, I mean that it boiled the experience down to its most basic element, which is two or more workers coming together to solve a problem.
What have been some of the biggest challenges along the way?
We're about 5 years old. I guess we're going into our sixth year. If we had known, and I'm probably not the first person to say this, but if Michelle and I had known how difficult it would be to grow an organization, to attract significant funding, like funding you can actually build an organization on, rather than one-time investments that are like innovation funding, which is helpful, but it's not sustainable. I don't know that we would have embarked on this. That part, it's been slower than we imagined at that time. We were extremely naive about what it would take.
And I think it seems to me that that's actually one of the very common denominators among people starting organizations and political organizations among them, that if you don't have that level of naivete, you don't do it.
Yeah.
It is hard.
Yeah, it definitely requires some amount of self-delusion of your abilities.
So at this point, like how big is the organization and what has it grown to?
So we're currently hiring two positions. We're a seven-person team currently. We were a three-person team up until last year, or I should say up until the fall of 2017. We're now, we're, it feels like things are moving at a faster clip now.
They tend to.
Yeah.
You kind of need to build, you kind of, it's like a snowball. You kind of need to roll it for a while.
Is that, well, the thing I tell myself, because when you do this work, when you're trying to launch an organization, you look at your peers in the space and you compare yourself to them. And so I had to, it's a practice. I haven't mastered it yet, but I do believe that, I live in Western North Carolina. There's a lot of we go hiking a lot, and when you hike, you always say you hike your own hike. Like this is your own path to travel on. Don't worry about someone else who's running up the mountain. And I think the same is true when you're leading an organization. Everyone has a different origin story for how their organization was created. I think that origin story really can have an impact on how quickly you're able to generate funding and, or attract investors, and just how you sit in the space, and how, whether you have to articulate why you exist and kind of defend your existence, or if you're kind of welcomed with open arms. And I think for us, we definitely had to elbow our way in and kind of demand that we have the right to exist in the space, because for many, we were too abstract of an idea in the beginning, and folks didn't really understand why we were needed.
Right. It's always a big mixture of timing and connections and the saleability of the idea and your own talent and all those things. Who have been the funders? Where have you found the most help?
Early on, in the beginning, we did some fee-for-service work with labor organizations. We actually had a wonderful relationship with a union in Australia and worked with them for 2 years to bring our model to Australia, which culminated in now they have the Victorian Trades Hall has a has a control shift instance, and the unions in Australia use that to mobilize their members. So that was one of the primary ways that we were supported in those early years. Recently, we have a pretty, I think there are more than 15, institutional funders that support our work, ranging from like the Ford Foundation, the Jam Kaplan Foundation, which is a family foundation based in New York. OMDR Network is another funder. There's no one size fits all. Like we've got a pretty diverse group of funders, which I guess is a good thing. You want to keep it diverse if you can.
What is a yearly budget for you approximately now?
We've surpassed an important milestone, which is we're now above $1 million a year. And that was like a very celebratory moment for us.
I have a lot of respect for $1 million. It takes an awful lot of people working hard generally to earn that.
Yeah. My co-founder, Michelle, shares the burden, or has the burden of being more of the money person of the organization. So
did you build your own technology? Do you partner with other organizations? I mean, you had mentioned Control Shift. Where are you on that?
When we were launching Coworker, one of my primary concerns was that I didn't want to be in the business of building software, building technology. I knew that wasn't in our skill sets. Like Michelle and I lacked that skill set completely. And I knew that would be, a boondoggle. Like if I tried to build my own software, it would probably be a disaster and it would be too costly. So we were looking for a solution, and it was actually at a Roots camp that, gosh, I think it might have been Taryn that introduced me to Nathan Woodhull. Nathan at the time hadn't launched Control Shift. He was doing some work with GetUp in Australia, but it hadn't, I hadn't seen it in use in the United States or anywhere else. And we just started talking at Roots Camp about what we wanted to do with Coworker and what he wanted to do with Control Shift. And we realized that there was just a shared vision there and a shared set of values around the power of individuals to come together and make change. And so we just became collaborators, and we were fortunate enough to get an in-kind contribution from ThoughtWorks that helped us do some customization of the Control Shift platform for workplace organizing specifically. Like one of the tweaks that we made to the technology was the ability for, if you created a campaign on Coworker, the petition always asks if you work for the targeted employer. So do you work for Walmart? And, our Control Shift instance allowed people to just engage folks in that community, like the coworkers, not the rest of the general public who supported their campaign. So for example, you could, send a message through our platform and say, I want everyone to wear red tomorrow in support of our fired colleague, which is obviously not a message you'd share with the broader list. So, you know, that, and then we use ActionKit as our CRM and our sort of our user database. Those are like the two biggest pieces of technology. The two that we use on a daily basis. And then Control Shift has continued to kind of evolve over the years, and we're continuing to think about like what the future of that collaboration could look like and how we can expand our platform and get workers using some of the other tools that Control Shift offers.
The workers that you're working with, like, what have been some of the successes that you've seen?
Sure. So, you know, the first big breakthrough on Coworker was a 24-year-old barista, maybe she was 23, barista in Atlanta named Christy Williams. And Christy had had a tattoo of her daughter's name on her arm that she had to cover up at work every day. And it was Atlanta, and it was in the summertime, and the air conditioning broke in her store. And she wanted to take off her compression sleeves that were covering up her tattoo. And her manager said that she couldn't because the company did not allow for workers to have visible tattoos. And the manager said, "There's nothing you can do. I understand. I'm sorry." So frustrated, she found coworker.org and started a campaign and recruited more than 14,000 of her coworkers from around the world in a matter of weeks. And we did, you know, she had these great ideas for follow-up actions. She invited all the baristas who joined her campaign to take photos of their tattoos and to hashtag it to be a partner, which is Starbucks's own internal hashtag that they like use for internal company-wide communication on social media. And so, you know, one day their comms department woke up and saw that like there was just a flood of wonderful, awesome looking barista tattoos on their internal channels. And also through that campaign, you know, they won. Christy won. And so, you know, about 6 weeks after her campaign launched, Starbucks announced that they were going to allow visible tattoos. But it also just spawned a variety of campaigns inside Starbucks. And then it inspired workers in a bunch of different companies to start similar dress code campaigns on the platform. The Starbucks workers on our site have gone on to win. They also had a dress code improvement with being allowed to have dyed hair. They won scheduling improvements. They've won higher wages for more veteran employees, paid sick days, expanded paid parental leave, which was a victory from early last year. And then most recently, there's been a campaign on our site around safe needle disposal in Starbucks customer bathrooms, where workers have been getting pricked by needles. And so they've requested like safe disposal boxes, and that's not a national victory, but the Starbucks has begun installing them in certain cities where that's been a documented problem. So there are over 50 Starbucks campaigns on our platform. We have more than 15% of the company's global workforce as part of our community, and it's one of the larger parts of our community. But it started with that first campaign by Christy Williams on tattoos. And then in other companies, you know, we recently, like 2 months ago, I think Publix grocery stores, which is a popular grocery store chain in the South, they announced that they're going to allow their employees to grow beards. That was a hard-fought 3-year campaign on our platform that more than 10,000. Yeah. REI employees a couple years back used our platform to kind of develop a very savvy organizing campaign with Seattle flagship store employees. And then they partnered also with Seattle City Council members and local unions in Seattle to win a 5 to 15% wage increase in stores around the country. And right now they're fighting for a $15 an hour minimum wage nationwide at the store.
Part of what I'm trying to do with you is sort of fit you into politics today a little bit, even though you're a 501c3 and you're pro worker regardless, but just try to understand how your site might play in some of the larger stories. How do you see that?
Well, I mean, I think that when workers are taking collective action in the workplace, you're elevating issues that have been impacting the U.S. workforce for decades that have gone either unnoticed or haven't been a political or legislative priority. So I definitely see worker organizing as complementary to policymaking and, you know, candidates that address the concerns that workers are raising, whether it's, you know, wildcat teacher strikes or, you know, the global Google walkout and Me Too movement. Like, I think that they go hand in hand. And without that, like, kind of grassroots worker organizing, you're not going to have the kind of policy solutions that you need to address the problems in our economy.
Sorry. It seems like we've really, I don't know, my sense is anyway, that sort of awareness of collective organizing that we had in this country at the height of the union movement has really receded, and the economy has changed a lot, and the techniques used to fight unions and to give them a bad name have really pushed things back. Do you see it that way?
Oh, certainly. Yes. But I also, not to nerd out too much, but I try to read as much as I can about the pre, you know, NLRA labor movement, both in the United States and other parts of the world. But, you know, the history of the labor movement is very long, much longer than the last century. And it has looked different at different times. It has, you know, the one that we have today was enshrined into law in the 1930s. The one we might have 100 years from now, I think will look quite different. And I think we're in the midst of this, like, regeneration, trying to figure out how this economy, which is quite different than it was in 1934, how we can build a labor movement that effectively holds power for workers in that economy.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating to think about what you're doing as a form of unionizing, right? As a form of sort of 21st century online connecting of people to mobilize for each other in a way that, you know, is totally different, but maybe a fit for what's going on right now in a lot of ways.
Right. If you take the definition of union, I mean, there's a legal definition of what a union is in this country, which we are not. You know, we don't negotiate with employers on behalf of workers. But if you think of unions as just workers coming together to advocate for improvements to make their work lives better, then of course, yeah, that perhaps we're stretching and pushing what the definition of a union could be in the future.
I mean, so it's one thing if Target is a bunch of employees at a big, more anonymous corporation like Target are using your platform. But what if you have, you know, a 10-person enterprise or a 50-person enterprise or a 100-person? Do you find people using your platform in those contexts?
Yes. I will say that I do not think that we can ever be like the right platform for every kind of worker. We've supported workers behind the scenes at small companies that haven't run public-facing campaigns, but we've helped connect them to legal resources, regulatory folks who can help, you know, with processing complaints and investigating. So we've done that. And then on the petition side, we have had employees of smaller chains run campaigns on our site. One that comes to mind is a bartender who ran a campaign at her Southern restaurant chain called Tupelo Honey Cafe. And she launched the campaign because she had seen that the restaurant had cut wages for support staff and was forcing, you know, the front of the house employees to tip out to kind of cover the decrease in salary. Basically everybody was earning less, but the support staff were the worst hurt. And they were being now paid as a tipped employee, even though they didn't perform, you know, a job where they were tipped directly by customers. So that, you know, that was a learning experience for us, but there were, I think, almost 100 employees from that regional restaurant chain. I don't know how many locations they have, but it can't be that many. It's a pretty small chain that joined her in different cities to support her. That because of the pressure, like the woman who ran that campaign told me, when one night she was bartending and a customer came in, sat down at the bar and asked her if she knew about this petition that she had started. When you have an employer that is so rooted in community in these small towns, for example, like you actually can generate quite a lot of pressure on an employer by just getting some local media, which she did. She got some local TV and print media. And eventually the company decided to roll back the wage cuts and to restore the wages to the level they were before. So I've seen evidence that it can work. I think that our model, you know, has gotten the most traction among workers of consumer-facing brands that are national or global. And that's because the medium is most effective, I think, with those employers and those companies.
What advice would you give to someone else starting up a political organization based on the learning you've done over the last few years?
I was very fortunate. And I think there are a ton of barriers for people that shouldn't be there. So, I mean, I almost have advice for the gatekeepers, not the folks who are trying to start an organization, but the gatekeepers need to take more risks and actively seek out smart, talented organizers and staffers who have ideas but don't have the connections or did never had it. I mean, the fact that I did work in the labor movement allowed me to have some savings, which I spent entirely in the first 6 months of Coworker. I lived off of, and without that, I couldn't have started my organization. If folks want more ideas and more experiments, then they have to be funded and supported, because it's an incredibly scary thing to quit your job. And the only reason I did that is because NOI offered me a fellowship. And I don't see a lot of opportunities right now that are similar for folks. And I wish there were more.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Is there a question I should have asked that I failed to?
No, I mean, I think we covered quite a bit of ground. This was fun. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate your taking the time today. And anything else you want to say?
No, I appreciate what you're doing, Nathaniel. Thanks for kind of mining people's histories and helping us all learn from each other.
Well, thank you too. And thank you for the work you're doing.
That was Jess Kutch. She's at coworker.org. I'm very interested to see how coworkers' place in a 21st century workers' rights battle evolves. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.